Call the resources meeting back. Forward and try to go through the bill, and we can ask technical questions at the same time we ask the department, the engineer online. We do have Mr. Van Dyke with the Division of Oil and Gas and Mr. Frank Paskvan. He's a reservoir engineer, or petroleum engineer with BP in Anchorage, and they were both both very helpful in the Oil and Gas Committee. So with that, Representative Roper, I don't know if you want to start by going through the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I could very briefly, just to help the committee understand it a little better. What we've done here at this CS, and I appreciate Mr. Chenoweth's Chenoweth late night hours. He's doing a lot of them lately. But what we've done, if I could refer the committee to the letter from Ms. Wilson dated April 19, 2006, which she presented the outline of to the committee yesterday. I've gone through it and made some executive decisions about accepting substantially a number of her recommendations and had them incorporated into the CS. And I can just very quickly indicate that. And her item number one, which would be our item number one, and if you have the changes before you, here.
And does everybody have the changes?
In the energy, renewable energy credit area, which is the 0.028 section, we changed the term qualified capital expenditure to qualified renewable energy expenditure. Make a distinction there. At the recommendation of Ms. Wilson, we left the term qualified capital expense in the bill for the 062 or heavy oil, if you will, or challenged oil area. So we accepted half of that. The on her number two challenge, changing the term, the name of it, we decided not to do that, but we'll be revisiting what those are defined as. On let's see, page two, lines eight. Oh yeah, the second change was the deletions of the safe harbor provisions or the 90% rules. Those are spoken to. The idea is to be consistent with 488, so we didn't want to have any confusion. So we just deleted those from the bill. Then on page 5, line 4.
Excuse me, Representative Roekberg, on page 2, you say lines 8 through 18 on the out of the I version.
Well,
I had marked on my page here, it was line 18 through 28.
Let me just get my other. That's what we have. Well,
let's make sure the right
the
part.
Problem
the
is
right,
that the,
right
yeah, this. Ms. Wilson's letter was written against the Y version, and we adopted the I version yesterday. So,
okay.
And now we have the L version. That's kind of trouble here. So
okay.
That explains some of the differences. That was regarded the safe harbor provision. Those came out.
That's the budgeted amount, so that you're not trying to audit against somebody's
right.
budget. Okay.
And let's see, the next one would be that's the problem here, having to refer back to the Y version of myself here.
If I might.
Ms. Wilson, help me out.
Yes, for the record, my name is Robin Wilson, I'm Director of the Tax Division, and I believe the, my item five on my letter of April 19th is now currently on page two, lines 25 through 27.
Of what version?
Of the latest L.
L, okay.
And that's the one that we had talked originally about numbering, so that we didn't have any confusion on in-state research, but also the development. We had talked yesterday about numbering those items. All of it must be in-state, not just the research. That's the discuss, that's the point.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I had a couple of different comments on that, but one of them was, depending on the committee's intention, perhaps putting little one, little two, little three would be helpful.
Okay.
We have that one, then we have page three, line 12. I don't know what that is.
There you go.
Well, this was the more than once, which is also in the other section that should have been deleted. That was a recommendation to remove that particular area. Let's see, that would be I'm not sure we got them all here.
If I might.
Go right ahead.
Yes, looking at my item number six, where I asked about how average was calculated. I believe that's been taken care of in this CS.
It's supposed to have been. And that was, I'm looking for.
Yeah, you can find it on page 3, line 26 of the current L version. And then I also, I had a question about just the phrasing of little two versus little one, but we can talk about that. And the more than once, I'll take
I didn't take that issue up.
Yeah, that's fine.
And then on Mr. Chairman, I didn't have a chance to read this either before I got here. It was hot off the press. So
I believe that more than once is gone.
Once more.
So we're getting three.
Yes, on page two, lines 18 and 19, E used to have number one, number two, paragraph one and two. It now just is all together, so that takes care of the problem about more than once.
Right.
Okay, so that's taken care of.
Then on the
that means it, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Removing that means that it can be taken more than once.
No.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I had raised a concern about what more than once meant. And under the PPT, you know, for a qualified capital expenditure, there is a deduction and there is a credit for the 20%. Alternatively, if it's for exploration, a credit can be taken under 025. But, you know, in effect, there is sort of the setup where it's taken more than once. So we envision in this bill is that there's a vision of a 15% credit on top of the 20% credit under the PPT. So I believe taking out the phrase more than once is consistent with the sponsor's intention.
Okay, so then this could also be in addition to the 40%.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is my understanding. Yes.
Yeah, it's like it's the PPT. It defaults to the PPT methodology.
Mm-hmm.
So on the truly, the true exploration, the 185 credits, if somebody chose to go with the 40%, if you're the mileage, whatever, 25 miles or whatever it is, you could qualify for the 40% and then qualify for this as well. Although in reality, the 185 credits are not used very much. I mean, nobody, they're just not used. So.
That is correct.
Commissioner, isn't there an election under the 185 credits, though? You can't take them. You got to take one or the other.
Yes.
Right? So it'd be max 40 under that, right? You're shaking your head, Paul.
Well, not if we take out the more than once here, because then you could use this 15% in addition to the 40%.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, so it would be 55%, and then there would be the tax rate reduction of 20-some-odd percent. So we would be picking up 40, 55, 75, 78, yeah, 75% is, yeah.
We're at 60 now, though, as PPT passed out here.
Yeah, 60 plus 15 is 75. That's correct.
Representative Crawford.
The way it's drafted currently.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if it would change your outlook on it if what we end up at the end of the day on a PPT where we have a base 25% credit, which is being proposed in the other body right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
If you want to work this as a more of a work session and a
yes.
hearing.
Yeah.
So everybody.
I was going to start yelling at each other. We can have as much information as we can.
That's a good question, because what the intention here was to do is using a 20% baseline and add on to that. Part of that, when my thinking was that we're the Senate version or other versions that have been discussed in the legislature stay at a 25% tax rate. If we had additional credits, that would offset some of those increases in taxes if, in fact, it was investment in heavy oil. And the testimony has been, even in this committee before, at a $60 level, there was a 5-to-1 ratio of credits to tax. So each 5 points of tax credit would be equivalent to 1 point of tax. So that's why I selected 15%, so that would be equivalent to 3 points of tax, which to me is kind of where the Senate ended up, or has got to that now at about 22.5 kind of thing. Yeah. Just that was my thinking, so you understand where I was coming from. But it also is more. It was specifically towards heavy oil. So that wasn't quite true. It'd be only true as to a heavy oil prospector activity. So it's not a universal thing. In other words, the ratio isn't exactly right. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of the way I intellectually put it together, you know. But I think Representative Seaton had concerns about adding on. It's like the piling on issue. Because in the PPT, there's a cap of, what, 20% max per annum? No?
That's only the purchase credit.
Yeah, that's the purchase credit.
Was that just the purchase credit?
Yeah.
Not all the other credits.
I mean, at one time, I mean, the way the PPT, and I haven't heard a lot of discussion about that changing, is Representative Seaton is correct. You can get up to 60 right now, but that 40% credit it's just not used very much.
Right.
I mean, it is for true exploration.
Real wildcat.
So
25 miles out or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
From the
exactly
border of a current unit.
I'm getting a nod from the back of the room there that's 25 miles.
25 miles and 3 miles.
Yeah.
That's
20%, right?
That's the 40.
And 3 miles is 20%.
Right.
Then you load 3 miles at 25 miles.
You get the 40%. Right.
So, I mean, it kind of begs the question, is it $70 a barrel we woke up to this morning? You know, do you need an incentive? I mean, I realize you're trying to look very long term on the incentivification, but and I don't know if there's a way to have the incentives decrease over time or variable a little bit with the price of oil, because at $70 a barrel, Mr. Spencer, I don't know if you agree or disagree with this statement, but at $70 a barrel, everything makes money.
Representative Samuels, not necessarily.
Not, okay.
It helps a lot of things.
It helped, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just, to help the committee here focus today, if I could, before we go on to finish up this, is that I think there's some policy calls that I would need some help from the committee about, and Representative Crawford brings one of them up, is that, you know, what is the 15% now, right? Assuming all things being equal, we're taking the 2020 route of 488, or we're going to look at the Senate's bill. So how does that fit in there? I believe one of the rationales, I haven't confirmed this, one of the rationales for the Senate to go to the 25% credit was in part to take care of this issue by raising the tax credits up to make sure there was sufficient credit to incent this type of development. So then, if that's going to be the baseline credit, I would be the first to admit that perhaps a 15 would be too high. If that was going to be the baseline. Yeah, then it should be lowered to 10% given my thought process. If, you know, as a matter of policy. Another one of the, that's a policy issue that needs to be considered. One of the other issues I think is very important is the issue of whether or not, when I first drafted this bill, it was intended to be focused on the research development activities that related to viscous or heavy oil. And it was broader in scope in a certain sense, but because it was all-inclusive, it included not only the research portions of using new technology, but it used also development. So it actually was broad-brushed for all of heavy oil. But there's another consideration the committee might want to take, discuss it briefly with the chairman, is whether or not we should narrow the focus of this legislation to just new research and technology, and not have it generally applicable to ongoing development of heavy oil. And so that would actually narrow it down, and its impact financially would be substantially decreased, albeit I think the concept and policy that we want to incent that type of new technology would be enhanced by that. So that it's a different focus. This is a policy. So you could have, you know, whatever you would determine the rate of credit to be, if it was drafted more narrowly to just such things as pilot projects, we'll find in a new draft that took the enhanced recovery new technologies out of this draft. But if we were to do that, we should put them back in, I think, because it's a specific item that we can identify, which is a new technology. And if that was going to be done, we should have that. Another earlier iteration of the bill, I had 25,000 linear feet of extended reach drilling. As we saw in the presentation yesterday, it had these spider developments of the they call them the spider patterns and the heavy oil pads. That's the new technology. And that should be, because we get a typical 400 barrel per day well up to 1,500 to 2,000 barrels a day. I mean, that's huge. But that was a very expensive. I mean, Mr. Spencer, what was the rough dollar investment in 1E and 1J? This range?
Representative Roper, generally those wells were $8 to $10 million per well. We've had some excursions well beyond that, though.
Does that include all the multiple patterns and the holes you've drilled in them, or?
Yeah, that would be per well, so we'd have maybe up to 3 trilaterals for one well.
And old bore holes all over the place, the spider legs, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or tracking your sands and all that. Yeah.
Correct. You like I said, on a per well basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, then it would be a call whether that should be or that's normal operation.
Yeah. Mr. Spencer, for the R&D, if we switch the bill to the R&D, or even if we don't do anything for the R&D and move forward with just a more standard credit mechanism, and I know that Mr. Wenzel yesterday testified about how you allocate and the R&D portions of there. Do you allocate anything for heavy oil or per project where you say this research is being done solely for heavy oil? when you're doing research like that, I mean, can you put your finger saying, we're going to spend $40 million on research dealing with heavy oil? I mean, is it that fine-tuned in there, and how would we know that that's what you're doing in a blue sky research development plant?
Representative Samuels, I spoke a lot yesterday. I was wondering if maybe we could have Frank Paskvan comment on that, and I'll follow up because I do have an answer for that.
I was going to ask Frank the same exact question to see if the companies do it differently, to see if BP does it differently than Conoco does it, because it'd be important to see not everybody has the same business model you do. So, Mr. Paskvan, are you with us, Frank? Frank? He stepped away. Representative Roper, yes.
I had to leave for a few minutes to go to House Finance, but...
Sorry to interrupt. This is Frank, if I'm online.
Yeah, stand by 1 second, Frank. I have a question for you. Go ahead, Representative Roper.
Yeah, I'll be leaving if, I don't know if you could, maybe you can ask Ms. Wilson to help walk us through what we've got here after you finish the line of questions, and then Mr. Spencer wanted to offer this definition to the committee as you go through it. I would appreciate that, too.
Okay.
And I have a bill up. I'll try to be back as quickly as possible.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Paskvan, did you hear the question that we asked earlier about research and development? One idea that Representative Roper kind of floated here was if you turned it into a credit just for research on heavy oil recovery, or if we even leave the bill in a closer form to what it is now, it's being proposed that research be get a tax credit for it. How does BP allocate? Do you have specific monies that you spend in the state on that you consider research, or do you have a research facility somewhere on the planet that you would do heavy oil research, and do you do research on a specific type of gravity like that, or you do just general more efficient drilling techniques as research, or do you know?
Well, Representative Samuels, we do engage in a number of different areas of research, and if this bill were to be changed to say research only, I think that we would find that acceptable as there are other provisions for development credits. But in terms of the language of this bill, it would be appropriate, I think, to give credit to research for by Alaskan oil companies, specifically for Alaskan fields, to incentivize activities which are related to particular fields of interest to Alaska. But one caveat to that may be that we do have activities which can only be performed outside of the state of Alaska. For example, if we were going to envision an UGNU development using microbial activities, we might need to go to a particular, not even inside of our own company, but a third party and do that work somewhere where those facilities do exist.
And currently, do you allocate monies? I mean, when the Alaska team goes to London or wherever your headquarters is in the Lower 48 to allocate for capital money, do you also allocate for more research money, specifically separately or specifically dealing with either heavy oil or carbonates or something like that?
Representative Samuels, yes, we do have specific research budgets for particular fields. They're typically expense items, and we would name those and collaborate on the funding of those with the co-owners of a particular field. So, for example, I'm thinking of last year we had an Orion Field Studies budget with specific line items for particular areas of research.
Okay. And I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Spencer just a moment ago. Is there have been some thoughts here regarding this legislation that at $70 a barrel, what do we need to incentivize things more for? The price is the incentive. And do you have a comment on that?
Representative Samuels, yes, I do. If I may, as following the dialogue earlier, that in context was referring to the exploration credit for wildcats, and I believe it was stated that there was not any particular use of that credit, which would, in my mind, indicate that the lack of use of that credit means it's not incentivized enough either by existing statutes or by the current oil price, and that's the stimulation that we're seeking. Further, these challenged oil reservoirs that we're trying to produce are differentially challenged to the light oil, and I believe contextually that since the bulk of current development comes from light oil, it may be that those current legislation primarily considers the bulk of the activities, and challenged oil will always face greater economic challenges than that category of development.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thanks. So then, if we were looking at incentivizing, like with the, like in the Senate bill, which is talking about 25% and trying to get more incentive there so that you could do heavy oil, actually what you're saying is we should not do that on all oil, because, and we should drop that back down and then specifically incent for heavy oil so that there's a differential there. Is that what I'm understanding?
Through the chair, what the concept would that I was trying to convey was that the definitions of a challenged oil does have real productivity issues, real economic challenges. That, for example, to my knowledge, the Ugnew formation, which is as huge, has only produced 17,000 barrels to date since its discovery 40-plus years ago. So, and the reason is it's challenged, and we would like to be able to develop that. It's and some of that lies within leases that we're participating in, and we're working on that, but economically and technically, it's a difficult target to develop.
Under the current ELF system, where the amount that was being produced, the incentive, the tax rate was zero, and there was no production there. Is that right?
Through the chair, this is Frank Pasfan speaking again, and I'm working in western region of Prudhoe Bay, and Prudhoe Bay has an aggregated ELF since January 12th of 2005, and so we pay the same, any oil produced within Prudhoe Bay, be it from the Ugnew or Schrader or Main Field, pays the same severance tax rate under the aggregated ELF.
But that only got aggregated this last year, so previous to that, the low rate of production there would have been basically at zero ELF, wouldn't it?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And further to that question, yes, for the last 40 years, but we haven't yet produced much of that which we're trying to incent through this particular bill.
Okay.
And does some of that rely on the technology of the horizontal wells and bacterial and all the other things that are being, those things making a change?
Through the chair, we definitely are making advances. Our current investments are targeting the Schrader Bluff and West Sac formations, and in that formation, horizontal well drilling, and in particular, multilateral horizontal well drilling is being employed. In the case of the Schrader Bluff, West Sac, Ugnew formations, the zones are relatively thin, and so instead of Prudhoe, which is a 400-foot thick interval, you might have only 20 feet thick, and so each zone has to have its own completion, its own well drilled out horizontally.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is it's a hard question for me to ask, but because I just don't know enough. But over the last several years, we've been listening to predictions as to what they were going to produce in heavy oil, and they would say at $40 to $50 a barrel, we might produce 4 billion, 5 billion. Barrels of heavy oil. At $60 a barrel, we might produce 5 to 6 billion barrels of oil. I'm sure I don't have the numbers right, but I mean, to give you an idea of the progression there, what I would like to know is how much does this bill change that that scenario? Does it move it down to $35 a barrel as the price floor? Does it produce another billion barrels at $60 a barrel? Does anybody have any idea what these incentives might get us, or is it really the price per barrel that's going to get us the oil, no matter what we do here on the incentives? And where's the low end that this might advantage us to get more oil drilled? Because certainly I won't. I mean, that's my impetus here, is to get more oil drilled, and I want to know if this is the way to do that. And if anybody can enlighten me a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Well, through the chair, this is Frank Pascan. If I may speak to a project a little closer to home, which is our Western Region development, we're looking at investments now on the order of $1 billion on a particular project. In an aggregate, it's around $2 billion, and honestly, given what happened with the ELF last year, that put us basically on hold for a year. We're still working underneath that framework and see that additional changes to the tax structure would substantially increase the likelihood of approval of the project. And further, we do need to visit with our respective board of directors. So we can't state at this time whether this would make a difference or not, but this incentive would substantially increase the likelihood of that our boards will be able to develop this challenging oil target.
So a great big probably maybe.
Through the chair, it definitely will help.
So, yeah, Frank, this is Ralph Samuels again. The question that we asked Conoco yesterday is, when you get to the R&D portion of this, is how many places around the world do you look for heavy oil, or do you have fields that have heavy oil in, and do those places also, I mean, obviously we'd like the technology to be there, but I don't think I want to pay for 100% of the research costs, and the fear that I've got is if you're doing research in London, because that's where your facility is, or at Conoco's bases in Oklahoma, I believe, how much of that are you really doing specifically for heavy oil, and how much are you doing it that you're going to use the technology around the world on every type of oil and every type of exploration? So that's the problem that we have with the audit function on the research is how many other heavy oil projects do you have around the world, and how much heavy oil do you have in the ground that you have trouble recovering?
Representative Samuels, we do have a few, but it's kind of a new technology area for BP, and it's interesting. We had a heavy oil symposium that was held here in Alaska, because they see us here as the leading edge for the company. But as we move into other provinces, there is certainly other heavy oil resources. But as per the research activities, we do specifically target those research activities and tailor it to a particular field. And so through the audit function, both on the part of the state, but also on the part of our co-owners, who I might say keep a keen eye on the purse strings as well, do allow a transparent audit of expenditures so as to not, you know, try and fund the worldwide research through this particular vehicle.
Mr. Spencer.
Representative Samuels, just for the record, this is Jeff Spencer with ConocoPhillips. Covered a lot of ground here in the last couple of minutes. I wanted to address just a couple of issues. First, on the R&D side, not sure that's exactly the right terminology, at least in my mind. We've got company experts located in Houston and Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And oftentimes, we basically contract with them to do a study, a reservoir study, or rock mechanics study specifically for an Alaska asset, because that's where the expertise resides. Those are legitimate expenses for an Alaska asset, which we then, as Frank mentioned, we charge to co-owners. And if you know the co-owners have that purview of whether they're willing to pay for that or not, and they're not going to pay for stuff that's not specifically tied to that asset. And so that's the kind of stuff that to me should be covered in a bill like this, is the stuff that's directly tied to an Alaska asset, whether the work's done here in Alaska or if it's done by other experts around the world. That makes sense.
Comment on that? I'd like to maybe get to DNR. We've got, I believe, Bill Van Dyke is online, and we never heard from them yesterday, but Ms. Wilson, go ahead.
Yes, if I could, just on point, specifically one of the questions asked yesterday was about federal credits for research. Would this be an appropriate time to address that? Okay, there is a federal credit for research, basically at 20%, and it goes through a number of requirements, but I did find of interest the fact that it does not, activities outside the country are not creditable. So that would be just something to perhaps think about, but that credit is available federally. It's sort of a convoluted calculation, but it does exist.
I can assume that ConocoPhillips and BP both take advantage of that federal credit, or do you know?
Representative Samuels, I couldn't answer that question. I'm not sure that we do.
Okay. Mr. Pascan, do you know if BP takes advantage of that credit for the
Representative Samuels, I sure hope so.
I hope so too, actually. So, with that, is Mr. Van Dyke online?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
I don't know if you had some general comments. I had one question, whether you do or don't. I've got one question I'd like you to address is, if we went to a system where you got heavy oil tax credits at a geographic area, West Sac, because it's been determined that all of the oil is heavy oil there. If we went to there and the seismic data, for the best knowledge that everybody from the industry and the state's perspective, is it's going to be heavy oil in a particular area. Once that first exploratory well is drilled, do we have access to that information? Is that in the public domain, or do you have confidential information? Because you'd hate to give the tax credit for heavy oil if you find out that the original data was wrong and that it's not heavy oil, it's light oil. Is that in the state? Does the state have access to that type of information once the first wells are dug, or as you go down the road, as every well is dug?
Mr. Chairman, Bill Van Dyke from Division Oil and Gas. As long as that well would be on state land, we would have access to the data once a well is drilled. So if they tested that well or took sidewall samples or downhole samples, we would have access to that data. It would be confidential for the first 2 years. would not be public, so but we would have access to it.
Okay, and what about NPRA? What about federal land?
Mr. Chairman, no, we would not have access to that data. Okay. That doesn't mean the companies couldn't share that data with us, but they would have to volunteer to share that data.
Okay.
I guess I just had something for Ms. Wills. I don't know if I'm missing something here, but let's just presume for a moment that we had the Senate bill. We had 25% tax credit, 22.5% tax rate, and we have a 15% credit for heavy oil, and we have a 20% federal credit, and then we have a deductibility from federal income tax of 35%. So we're up to 117% of, I mean, is there, how much, even if we don't have this 15%, we're already still up to 102%, aren't we, of credits and tax rate deductions that are going to be allowed on?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I believe I did talk previously about the sort of buildup of the numbers, and I haven't done the math on those numbers. The other thing I'm not certain about is the federal credit for research. Quite often federally, if you take a credit for an expenditure, you're not necessarily going to get a deduction as well. With regard to the EOR federal credit, you do, but it's limited. And I can't remember now whether it's 80% deduction instead of 100%. But what that means is, in that case, you have a potential of going over 100%. For the pure research one, I'm not certain about the federal deduction. I can certainly look at that question.
Okay. At some point, I get confused here. When we're adding things up, and we had our consultants come in and tell us that when we started adding these things up, at high oil prices, I don't think any of this makes any difference because I think everything's economic. If it's economic to do and there's a lot of money on the table being made off of it, that should be a sufficient incentive to do it. And at low oil prices, this means the state incurs a large risk because there's no downside protection like we had in the other credits where it was at $40, you can apply them at less than $40 a barrel. So if we do have a lower downside, we're going to be picking up a whole lot of credit, what I look at. Thanks.
So back to DNR. Mr. Van Dyke, I've got it on my list here that you're online to answer questions. Do you have any just general comments on the legislation? I mean, almost on a philosophical level, do you have comments on heavy oil, an extra credit for heavy oil, whether it's included in the PPT or assuming that some form of PPT passed at 20 or 22 or 20 or 25 credit, something along those lines passes the legislature. Do you have any comments, just generally speaking, on how you would administer this from your perspective?
Mr. Chairman, again, Bill Van Dyke, I do have a couple comments. I guess I don't know whether Representative Roper made it back yet, but I certainly want to commend him for his persistence and his hard work on this bill. And I have previously testified that I think the viscous oil, it is challenged to develop and produce, but it's certainly not impossible to develop and produce. We have some development, some production in place today. As Mr. Pascavan testified, there's a relatively large project being considered in Prudhoe Bay. So there's going to be additional development and production of viscous oil with or without these additional tax credits. And I think that's where we need to sort of circle back and decide, what behavior, what are you really trying to change here? Because the incentive should go out there and should be designed to really change the behavior of the lessees in some, I think, very specific way. And I guess my focus would be to change behavior with respect to development of the known viscous oil that we have on the North Slope today. You'll focus on a specific development incentive because it is true for the 20 billion plus barrels of viscous oil in place on the North Slope, we have basically no development today in you know, relative terms. We're producing 40 or 50,000 barrels a day from a 20 billion plus resource. So I guess my hope would be we could incentivize development of the viscous oil we have in place today. And I guess in that regard, I'd prefer to, as you suggested, to just list the units, list the formations where these credits might be applied. And that would be, you know, the Schrader Bluff and West Sac and Agnew formations, and it would be the Kerr-McGee units, Tuvac and the Kachuk, and the ENI units at Rockflower, and then Prudhoe and Milne and Kuparuk, and have a catch-all phrase for future accumulations down the road, bring those in as needed and as appropriate, but really just focus on what we have in place today and try to accelerate development of that oil. I had some more specific comments on individual lines, but I'll just cut it off there for now.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thanks. And if we're trying to incentivize or change behavior up there, what time frame do we need to, I mean, it seems like we need a reasonable time frame, but we need it short enough so that it kicks people in the rear and says, oh, if I want to get this, I need to change my behavior and do it. Right now we have a 2016 date on there. Is that the reasonable date, or should we have it a shorter date to say, you know, we want you to work on developing this and we're going to give you some tax credits if you do it in the next 5 years, instead of looking out there 10 years and saying anything you decide to capitalize in 10 years is...
Chair, Representative Seaton, Bill Van Dyke, I certainly wouldn't make it any longer than 10 years for a 10-year sunset provision right now. I wouldn't make it any longer than that. And I guess nor would I make it much shorter given the way companies budget these days. You know, it'll take, if you really do incentivize development, it'll take probably 3 to 5 years just to see that occur. You know, there are some projects underway or being planned right now that I think are going to go forward regardless. But then if you really want to add that new layer of development, it'll take a while to get that through the planning and budget cycle.
And I guess I'm just trying to figure out how this works in the corporate structure is when projects are going. I mean, if we change that to 7 years, does that mean that they're going to recognize that to get those incentives, they're going to have to move forward on those issues? I mean, more quickly, and it's a cap. If we're talking about the capital expenditures instead of the research or development and capital expenditures, that's going to occur at the first part of the development anyway, isn't it?
Chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct, and it will take a while to get through the, you know, through the formal approval process, because these are, you're talking about large capital expenditures for, you know, if you really are going to incentivize a significant amount of development, it's going to involve a significant amount of expenditures.
So just to follow up, do you think if that was 7 years, that would be too short a time period for them to be able to make proposals, and knowing that the credits would be available if they do it instead of waiting around and putting it in their list?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that I'm sure the company reps will want to say something about that too. I think, you know,
we had one nodding here.
They could get a fair amount of work done in the next 7 years if they were so motivated.
Mr. Spencer.
Representative Samuels, just to give you an idea of the time horizon for some development like Agnew, perhaps, which could be billions of dollars of capital investment, it would take a couple of years of study. You'd want to do a pilot project to test the concepts of the recovery process. You'd want to run that pilot project for several years to understand really how productive the reservoir is, what the issues are with developing that, and then it would take at least 5 years to to build a new plant, perhaps, and start to drill your wells. So the time horizons are fairly long. So I believe that 10 years is an appropriate time frame and would help move some of those projects even faster.
Mr. Pascban.
Yes, Representative Samuels, on a personal note, I came back to Alaska in 1998 and began the planning for the project that we're moving ahead today, which we anticipate first oil on that in the year 2010. So that's a 12-year cycle there. And it's perhaps worthy of note that this project develops the reservoir in which there was a WestSAC pilot in 1988. So believe me, the life cycle on these projects is long. And if you look at the Alberta projects back 20 years ago when they were starting to do their oil sands development, we all kind of laughed at them because it was price of oil was, you know, they weren't making any money on it. But it's taken some time, but now Fort McMurray is just booming. So a longer view on the UGNU is going to be required to put in place, and it may be at the year, was it 2016 with the sunset here? We may be back asking you to extend that.
Okay, thank you. If you get to the major policy calls, and this, I guess, a question from Ms. Wilson. If we did not switch this to just a credit for research and the associated problems with doing that, do you include research, and how do you feel, I guess, about the ability to audit that? Everybody's kind of got the feel for what the issue is. We can't really look at what the rate is until we see kind of how PPT ends. I mean, if it ends up with the Senate rate at 25, or it could go up and it could go down. I mean, who knows how that ends for the base rate, the base credit rate on the other piece of legislation. And then the geography question, is that a question more for revenue, or is it a question for DNR? If we designated WestSAC as a heavy oil field and we had access to the information to make sure that it was above a specific gravity or below, however it works, how much of an audit problem is it to you? Is if the audit comes in on the weight of the oil, the problem with picking a number is if it's 24, what happens if it's 25 or 23? Do you now have to go back in time to disallow a credit which was given 2 years before? How do you picture that, the nuts and bolts of the bill? How do you picture that working? I'm going on my list of the policy choices, the R&D, the credit rate, geography versus weight versus method of recovery, which are all three kind of intermixed in the bill right now. And then I guess the other one was dealing with the rate also. So is it more of a question for DNR or for yourself?
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of thoughts, say, on the research. On the question of auditability of the API gravity, I would defer to Mr. Van Dyke, perhaps, for some insight on that. Would you like me to talk about the research?
Yeah, sure. Go through your thoughts on research.
Well, a couple of just thoughts.
And along the lines also, what Representative Rochberg had one thought of turning the bill into just a research credit bill. That is one idea that he floated.
Well, I would just offer a couple of thoughts in no particular order. I did hear some comments yesterday, perhaps, about pre-approving projects for research, and that makes sense to me, as long as, you know, sort of the criteria are articulated so that the department can judge whether a project is appropriate for the credit. Another thought might be, in addition to approving a project for the purpose that you want it for, you know, has it been taken federally? And if so, you know, the feds have a lot of criteria and so on that would, we could let the feds audit that. So, you know, perhaps piggybacking off of some of that would be helpful. That would preclude any foreign research from being included right off the bat. So that's a thought. And I think that's probably my initial thoughts on the research. And I also heard you, Mr. Chairman, mention perhaps a dollar limit on research, and that would certainly limit the state's exposure. So those are a couple of thoughts.
Okay, thank you. And I guess the next question would be for Mr. Van Dyke, then. If we talk about going to geography, the nuts and bolts of it, if there's an expenditure made for drilling a well and we give the heavy oil tax credit, or maybe we don't give it until it's proved, what do you do for oil that's kind of on the bubble? Wherever you draw it, it says it must be at a specific gravity, 20, 25, 18, whatever the magic number is. What happens if it is incorrect, or what happens if it fluctuates right around that number? One month it's above it, and one month it's below it. What kind of administrative problems would you see with I mean, you're talking a tremendous amount of money on this 15% credit. And if it goes up one dime, is that the way that it works, I guess, in the real world? Does the gravity of the oil going to change day by day, or does it pretty much, when you stick a hole in the ground and you're sucking oil out, it's 25? And I'll go first ask that question to DNR, and then I'd like to hear from Mr. Pascan and Mr. Spencer on kind of the nuts and bolts on when you stick a straw in the ground and suck it out. Does it change over time? Does it change minute by minute? And how would we administer it if it's on the bubble of the gravity marker?
Mr. Chairman, Bill Van Dyke, certainly the lighter oil, some of these reservoirs are sort of layer cakes with layers of oil of different viscosity, and the way the physics works, the lighter oil is going to flow easier first, so the viscosity of the oil coming out of the well could change over time because the more lighter oil will flow easier first, and the heavier oil is going to flow later in the life of the well, but so it could change over time. It's not going to change dramatically day after day, if things are going, you know, normal downhole.
Change over decades or over years?
Mr. Chairman, certainly over years it could change. And I guess, you know, we've talked about this, and I've talked to Representative Rochberg. I mean, and that's why I think if you decide to give some credits for viscous oil, I could just live with the idea of saying West Sac and Trader Bluff and Agnew, you know, in a given number of units, we'll just give the credits if that's the policy call. And then you don't have to measure viscosity and you don't have to measure API gravity because they are for the most part viscous oil reservoirs. They do have some oil that's above 25 degrees here and there, some scattered spots, but, you know, the majority of the oil is viscous oil. So I think I could live with the concept that if you're going to go there with credits at all, just name the units and name the formations, and we forego all the science of measurement.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Van Dyke. I had a question. One of the things that was already mentioned here was on this research we're doing is microbial and other recovery, and, it seems like we might be actually stimulating and trying to change the viscosity of the oil to enhance recovery, and then it's not eligible for the credits. So could that be a problem in what we're doing? I mean, we're trying to incentivize research into new techniques that basically, I think, are all aligned at reducing the viscosity.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you're correct. Quite a number of the enhanced oil recovery techniques that were listed in the prior versions of the bill, that's the reason that they work at the end of the day, is because either through heat or through using lighter hydrocarbon liquids, blending lighter viscosity liquids or microbial action, you've reduced the viscosity. You're exactly right.
So that would lend to your suggestion of just naming the fields and saying we're going to try to enhance recovery at these fields, and then not having to worry about that whatever goes forward. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Cedar, that's correct. And I mean, again, within the, I think, within a given, a reasonable sunset or period of time also.
Yeah. And your reasonable sunset was the 10 years again? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I could live with the 10 years. Yes.
Okay. I guess similar question to Mr. Spencer and then Mr. Baskvan. Once again, do you see the problem, even from the industry's perspective, you plan on a 15% tax credit for a certain expenditure, you're going to drill a well, and all of a sudden the oil is the measurement, if you have a measurement in there, changes over time? Do you concur with Mr. Van Dyke's comments that it just simply doesn't change except for over really long periods of time? How do you see the world in that on that issue?
Through the chair, this is Frank Baskvan. The reservoir itself, it doesn't change much, but there are processes. For example, the Orion oil pool, for example, has recently been approved by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to allow us to inject a miscible injectant into that formation, which will produce, will increase the API gravity above the threshold, I guess, on occasion, as you get slugs of oil that's been lightened in the reservoir. So I would very much echo Mr. Van Dyke's comments that a bi-pool inclusion would be sufficient, because it originally, as it started, was, we can characterize its distribution for viscosity, for API gravity. If it meets those criteria, then it's in, and we do have to do special techniques to get the oil out because of its original characteristics.
Spencer, ditto.
Representative Samuels, yes, I think a couple of things. Just to echo what Mr. Van Dyke had said, that over a long time, you might see some slight degradation in the oil quality for the reasons he states, that the lighter stuff will actually float first, so your API gravities might be higher initially, and then over time actually drop. Assuming that you're not injecting something else to artificially prop that up. So if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Are there any other comments, Ms. Wilson? Or?
Yes, just a couple of things. And as I've heard the discussion, I think it becomes clear that API would be sort of problematic, because if you incur expenses in 1 month and then the oil starts coming out the next month, but maybe the light stuff comes off first, and then we get into the heavy stuff, I think from a timing aspect there could be problems. The other thing I just wanted to mention in this area, I believe yesterday the committee asked me about the constitutionality of specific areas, and I spoke with Mr. Mintz this morning, and what he related is that there's a slight chance that could be a problem, but overall, if a state has a clear business reason for targeting a certain area, then that's easily overcome. So he didn't indicate that there would be an anticipated problem in that area.
I mean, my knee-jerk reaction, I don't know what everybody else thinks, my knee-jerk reaction is if DNR is okay with just saying, forget whether you like the bill or not, or you think we need to have the credits or not, but if we're going to go down the road, it would just make more sense to say, at West Sac, DNR says this is heavy oil. We can skip all of the methods of recovery. We can discuss research and development separately and say West Sac gets this credit. It seems to make more sense to me that as long as DNR has said that they're comfortable that it's all heavy oil,
it
tends to simplify it without having the testing and the going back and forth on the API gravity. I don't know what everybody else thinks about that as we go down the road. So,
and as we were talking about, I think that absolutely makes sense, because basically what we're trying to do is encourage people to develop techniques that would change the API score, and therefore it wouldn't be heavy oil. I mean, it wouldn't qualify. So I think that the very nature of the incentives, if we're talking about research and development incentives, is to get away from it being heavy. and so I fully agree with
that. That's whether you agree with the bill or the concept or not. We talked to Mr. Van Dyke at DNR, and his recommendation was just say we're going to have this, you know, you can get away from the API gravity and all the stuff. It says the West SAC gets the credit. And you could have a method in there where, or Agnew or wherever, Freighter Bluff, say these areas get the credit because the state has determined and they agree with the industry that that's where heavy oil is. It's all heavy oil, and if you run into a patch that's not heavy oil, it's not going to be much. Don't worry about it. I hate to paraphrase Mr. Van Dyke, but and that simplifies the entire process. And then you could have another process in there where it says if the state determines that, I don't know if you want to put it in the regulation or give the power to the commissioner, you have to come back to the legislature and say, you know, 20 years from now, this area is also determined to be heavy oil. And on that issue, it seems to simplify the discussion while you were gone, Representative Roekberg, was what happens if you get a credit and you say that it's at a specific gravity of 20, and that's where the credit starts. If it's above or below that, what happens if it's at 19 and a half or 20 and a half, and you had given them the credit, or they have to not know if they're going to get the credit when they do their economics, not knowing specifically what's going to kind of the nuts and bolts of the bill, and that kind of fixes that problem by just saying this area. And I don't know if you were here a moment ago, Ms. Wilson testified that she spoke with Mr. Mintz that there shouldn't be a constitutional problem with doing that. So you're kind of caught up on our last 45 minutes now. So in a nutshell, Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would just like to say that, you know, my feelings on this is basically we're establishing pilot projects, and we're saying WESAC, UGNU, whatever DNR says, these areas we're going to determine are available for this credit. And then I think anything else should have to come back to the legislature to establish, with DNR coming forward and industry saying, we've established another pool here and everything else, because I would hate to put it into regulation that the commissioner is now in charge of making this hundreds of million dollars decision of whether there's going to be a credit here or not. And so I think it should be a legislative choice.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, one reason that this latest CS does have the monthly averaging, which was intended to try to measure what the multiple different viscosity levels and try to overcome that. But and I can appreciate, I guess my concern is the one that we've found, at least anecdotally, in the application of Senate Bill 185 was that there was application for credits for that, and they have only been granted in some 40%. I don't know. Mr. Hurley, can you help me? Any idea?
Yeah, those are different kinds of credits, though. That's for the exploration.
I don't know, but if there's discretion on the part of the commissioner, right, we make application, only 40% of them are making the cut. And part of that is, and that was a little more specific. So if we take away an API gravity standard or don't have something like that, I'm a little nervous with it. On the other hand, I think the industry is supported, and Mr. Pathman has suggested, and now we have a new kind of a joint industry recommendation for definitions of what challenged oil is, that while it does include the API standard, it also has a geographic or formation identification issues here, which are, you know, I don't know, you haven't passed this around, Mr. Spencer? We might want to pass this around to the committee members now and take a look at it.
Copies of that.
Yeah.
Well, Representative Roekberg, do you have a disagreement with the legislature just saying, you know, getting with DNR and saying WESAC and UGNU and whatever several formations there are and saying
No, I don't, because the bill actually has included that.
Okay. And getting rid of the API.
It had the 25 and the 18 standards also, though. So they were somewhat redundant in a way.
Right.
And that's been one of the recommendations of industry, is how you can identify the marker is to call out the formation, I guess. So we'd have to, you know, by this definition, I'm not sure it's, I guess it's the comfort of how you define it. I guess my only discomfort is this phenomenon of too much discretion on part of the commissioner.
But if we simply say, I mean, for instance, let's, we just say it's WESAC, nowhere right else, or UGNU, the two of those areas, we're not going to bother to go measure it. We've got the core samples. We've got as much seismic as we need. It's all heavy oil. Those two areas, if you want another one, industry can come apply to the commissioner. The commissioner comes hand in hand with the industry and says, and we've got this other area. We want to apply the credit in area B also.
Did Mr. Van Dyke speak to that?
Mr. Van Dyke, are you still with us?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
I hope that I haven't put words into your mouth, but I tried to paraphrase a little bit about what you said as far as simplifying it. What would you think of the idea of just saying these areas, whatever these four or five areas are, you've made a determination that it is heavy oil, it is all heavy oil. We as a legislature choose to put a credit on that area, geographically speaking, and then as we move forward, just put a we could put the parameters in there as we move forward. If we had a specific gravity of X or in this range, then the industry may apply to the commissioner, and you have to approach the legislature, however you want to phrase it. But the legislature would then choose to add more geographic areas to the legislation or to the program then. What would you think of that, just generally speaking?
Mr. Chairman, that is the approach I supported. You would take the, I think it's six unit areas, you know, Prudhoe, Park, Milne, Tuvac, Nakachuk, Rockflower, and you would say within those unit areas, the Agnew Formation and Schrader Bluff and Westsac are defined as heavy oil and they qualify. And there would be no argument.
Well, what about the Princess Creek or whatever that's south of Kaparik? That would be a new area. I mean, we'd have a provision that allowed you to, for the commissioner to make the judgment in the future. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My intention is to say the commissioner doesn't make that decision. The division and the commissioner come to the legislature, and if the legislature wants to add another area, that's fine. But to, you know, we're talking. We were just told it was $2 billion, so we're talking, you know, under this $300 million of credits that are going to be applicable, and I don't think that we want to have the commissioner making that decision. I think that the legislature, if they want to come forward with enough information to say we have another formation here that is heavy oil and we're willing to share the data to show you it's heavy oil, then the legislature could pass a credit and say, yeah, we'll give credits for heavy oil development in that area.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't agree with that analysis. Only the one we passed out here does have the future participating areas formed to develop West Sac, Schrader Bluff, Agnew Formation, or their stratigraphic equivalents within the boundaries of the units named above or within these other units. So these are within those units. I'm concerned there because I'm aware that Chevron Unocal just took a very large acreage position south of the KRU for the exploration of heavy oil. It may not be in these definitions, and I don't think they should be restricted if they are strictly heavy oil prospect, you know, with the 5,500 total vertical depth standard. So why would they have to come to the legislature to get approval for something they already made an investment in to go forward in, and when they want to make an investment? So you basically restricted, if you were to take your default, they wouldn't be able to do that unless they came here to ask our permission. You know, so I don't think we should be that strict.
I think the flip side of that is you say that oil produced of API gravity of 18 or less, so we were at 18.5 once again, or 18.1, and you're on the bubble area right there.
Right.
Do you have to go in there and test all the time? They don't know whether they get the credit or not.
Right.
They wouldn't know until, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, Mr. Spencer, but you drill the hole, you don't really know until you drill. When you do your math on your project, and you're going back to get your money for the project, you won't know whether you're going to get this credit or not until you've drilled the well. You don't know if it's heavy oil or not until you've drilled the well.
Yeah, Representative Samuels, that is correct. You don't know with 100% certainty until you drill the well. You generally have a good idea going in. And then, you know, I don't think that would be a huge issue because if you thought you might be on the borderline, you'd have to factor that into your economic analysis. And if the project, say, wouldn't go with the, without the tax credit, maybe you don't invest at all. And so that would be more of an economic decision. If you thought it would still fly, if it was slightly over that, then the company would move forward with an investment. Many times the heavy oils we're talking about are going to be below the criteria that's listed here, and won't be a real issue as far as pushing up to that limit. So I don't see that there's a lot of significance to that. There may be one-off cases, but I would leave that up to the oil companies to determine if they would want to take that risk on and not getting a credit.
Mr. Van Dyke, what do you think about Representative Roepfer's scenario where you have a relatively new player coming into a relatively new area where Chevron comes in, they have acreage, they don't even know if they're going to be eligible for the credit. They don't even know, they'd have to come hat in hand to the legislature, and getting something through this process sometimes is more political and economic, to say the least. What do you think about the problems associated with that?
Mr. Chairman, I would support having, we'll just call it, some sort of a catch-all provision in the bill, and I know there's always a little bit of tension between the legislature and the administration on who gets to grant the credit, but I would hope you'd have a catch-all provision that would give the commissioner some discretion at a future date to add additional areas.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that would be my preference. I think Representative Seaton is trying to make sure that there's not an abuse of the discretion. But once you, it's like throwing yourself into the heart of regulation land versus statute. I've always opted for statute, but on this type of stuff, if it's going to be, yet this has a sunset on it, that may be our salvation in the future, is having some discretion within our tax regime. But and it might be able to me, I think it's a level of comfort that can be developed just so we make sure we flesh this out. Because just off the top of my head, if I can think of a scenario that occurs that this even suggested language, which is broader than we've had before, still falls short, I think we need some provision like that.
And you know, my only problem is that we're talking about giving the commissioner a $200 million or $300 million option. He's going to make a decision by the testimony here, is worth $300 million to a company. And I think that those kind of decisions come back to the legislature. I mean,
right. Mr. Chairman, if I could, excuse me for interrupting, but I think the commissioner is going to probably weigh on the cautionary side. So that might be it might militate towards less development than more development. It kind of depends on how aggressive they might be. I think the tendency is to be, and we've seen in the 185 credits, it's tend to be less active than we might have thought, even legislatively. And that's a pretty clear-cut standard that they have to meet there. You know, mileage and dollars. It doesn't, you know, I'm baffled why there is such a difficulty with that one even. So, I mean, that's the call we have to make. And I think, clearly, if a company wanted to come and ask for some legislative relief, under your thinking, they could do so if they ran into troubles with the department. You know, that would be the remediation. It would be easier to get a bill through than to sue. Might be cheaper, except I don't know about some of these lobbyists that anymore. You know. I guess the issue is we get rid of the 25 or the 18, then we have to have something like that.
Yeah. I've just put it down. I've gone through some of the issues, and I'd like to get back to Ms. Wilson maybe or Mr. Van Dyke. If you see other issues, the research and development, do you switch the entire bill? Do you keep it in? How do you audit for it? Is still an issue. Obviously, the rate, depending on what happens with PPT and how that ends up. The geography, which just designating these areas at least to start right now. And then moving on with what do you do with new areas?
On page 2, line 2, may be applied against any and all taxes. Is that more than production taxes? I mean, have we
I mean, we've been trying to make sure that all these things were constrained to not to income tax, not to
property taxes.
Property taxes, not to anything other than PPT. Does any and all taxes, does that refer to?
It says production. Ms. Wilson, on page 2, line 3, it says producers taxable oil and gas production. Does an income tax count as a tax on that line?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it identifies under this chapter, so that would be chapter 55, which would cover production tax only. Within the title 43, it is true that chapter 20 is income tax, but under this chapter, on line 3, it says under this chapter on oil and gas production, that restricts it to production tax. And then I note under on line 7, it says any tax due under this chapter. So I think we're okay.
Okay. Okay. Any other kind of broad issues? We'll need to make some decisions here in the next couple of days anyway. Representative Roper.
Chairman, I think it, the one issue that I'm very curious to get some feedback from the committee and their opinions is on this issue of breadth of the bill. You know, should this be new technology research or should it be broader applicable to all heavy oil activity? And that speaks, I think we need to make that decision and then some of the other things fall in place or they're easier to make decisions on. For example, I would say that I'm coming around the fact if maybe I've been influenced by the Senate version that I read about in the newspaper this morning, you know, it's about having a chance to read it, but if there's going to be a consensus developed in the legislature that we have a baseline of 25% as a tax credit, then I think that this bill has less value in its form now and might have more value if it was narrower in scope. So therefore, it would be more new technology, new research stuff, rather than just anything that had to do with heavy oil, per se. Mm-hmm. That way, we would be, you know, rifle shot.
I'm curious to see if Mr. Spencer comments on that. If you had to choose, if the bill was going to be, let's play real devil's advocate, if you took research out of the bill because of problems that I still see with auditing for the research, but you said development of WESAC gets a credit, or a bill that said we're going to incentivize your research so that you can now come to WESAC on your own.
Representative Samuels, it's my opinion that the real issue here is trying to incentivize development of these heavy oil resources, not research and development of some new technology. What you want is applying that technology to Alaskan fields to get the oil out of the ground through the pipeline so that everyone can benefit from it. And so from my perspective, the research and development portion is minimal because our research and development occurs around the world. If we learn something new somewhere else and it's going to help develop an Alaskan asset, we'll use it. The real value is actually in using it on an Alaskan asset. And that's where the industry needs help. I mean, like I said, these fields have been known for more than 30 years and have not been produced because they're very difficult. And any incentives that can be brought forward through a bill such as this for development, I think would be a very big boost to Alaska's economy.
Mr. Pascvan, your thoughts on the same subject?
Representative Samuels, I would concur and do see as I submitted in testimony to last week, the current investment decisions are on higher viscosity fields, and we're learning things today that we hope to apply to tomorrow's oil fields. But we need to continue the developments today in order to get to the place where we all want to be, which is that huge prize of the UGNU.
Mr. Spencer.
Through the chair, one last comment. An example of where tax incentives had a real boost is the Section 29 tax credits for coal bed methane development in the San Juan Basin. That was a kind of a new area. You know, 15 years ago, and because of the tax incentives, they did have a time limit. They said any development that occurs up until a certain time, and I forget the exact date, would qualify for that tax credit. Now the San Juan Basin is if not the largest, one of the largest gas-producing regions in North America. And the technology kind of developed because there was that incentive to invest in that area. And I see that as kind of an analogy to what I think the original intent of this bill was, is to try to incentivize development. And we'll figure out, hopefully, better ways to do it, but we have to start.
Ms. Wilson, did comments on the?
I don't have any further comments on that part.
Okay.
Was that in the Four Corners area, or is that in Wyoming?
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, that's in the northwest New Mexico area.
Right.
So Four Corners area. That's
right.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thanks.
Evergreen country.
Another broad area that we haven't really, I mean, we talked about, but that we need to work on is at what, is there a dollar per barrel price at which this credit is going to apply or not apply, or are we just going to say, even at $110 a barrel, we're going to give 15% credit, even though it's totally economic at that point or not? It just seems to me that unless we address the problem of, or the question of, do we need this incentive at high oil prices, we're kind of stuck. So I'd like to see that addressed somehow.
Okay. Any comments on that point?
Well, I do have a comment on that. Number one, I think a lot of that is being absorbed into the basic PPT bill by creating all standards based on a net profits type thing, even in progressivity. So, and you can make the same argument. Says, well, we're going to take care of heavy oil because even though the prices of development are higher, they'll be able to deduct that for net calculation. So you can make that argument. You don't need heavy oil incentives because they're going to get it anyway. On the other hand, we do have progressivity in, we will ultimately have some type of progressivity, I would believe. But I think that the having the sunset and having a period of time where we really want to make sure that there is an additional incentive has merit. And I'm just plucking my thoughts here. So I don't have that concern as much there.
Ms. Wilson? No comments on that one. Mr. Spencer?
Representative Samuels, I guess it's maybe easy to look at today and say, well, we've got $70 oil, but it wasn't that long ago that we had $10 a barrel of oil, 1998, okay? I've been through several of these cycles during my career, and one of the things everyone has to keep in mind is that the oil industry is a very capital-intensive industry. You spend a lot of money up front, and then they get that payout over 30 years. And so that's the key thing to keep in mind, is that there's no guarantee we'll be at 70 barrels of oil for the next 30 years. It could drop, and having these incentives now, at least you'll make that upfront investment and hopefully have a very sustainable heavy oil future for Alaska.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up, that's what the thought I was looking for in my mind there was the exact thing. The investment cycles on things of this nature are so long, you're going to get some volatility of pricing throughout that from the time you research it and then sanction it. By the time you start the investment into it, you're going to have a pretty lengthy period of time. I mean, for Spencer, could you use Polaris or Orion as newer type fields? What type of time frame was actually being undertaken by industry in those types of developments?
Through the chair, I think Mr. Pascman would be more up to speed on that. That's the area he works.
Through the chair, the Polaris and Orion developments are, we started really learning about those through the Westsac fields in 1988 with the pilot there. And like I say, we've been working on that since 1998, specifically on the Polaris oil field. and Orion just a year or two after that. But we're still making significant investment decisions today with respect to projects to be developed in 2010. But I would ask the committee to step back for a moment and recognize that the incentives that one might place through this bill are associated with that of the production tax. And again, you know, we've got, that's just one portion of the total state or Alaskan take of those barrels. And we'd all be pretty happy with those kind of prices on royalty oil as well.
Okay. Spencer.
Through the chair, just for the record, if Frank was referring to the Westac 1J pilot, that was actually in like 1982 or 83. It was the early 80s. But it's been a long time that we've been trying to get that oil out of the ground.
Well, if there's any other, you got more general issues?
Yeah, another general issue is on page.
Just 1 second here. What I'd like to do is maybe get through all of the big issues and then tomorrow give everybody a chance to think about it. And then tomorrow go through and make some of the policy choices while we either go through amendments or draft a CS for maybe Monday. Think about what, as we go down the list here, what these items are, what the committee wants to do. The credit rate, it'll depend on PPT, the geography, the research and development. Kind of go through in your own minds what you want to do, and then we'll come back in. I think we've got a short schedule. Tim, we've only got one item on the agenda tomorrow. We've got a board confirmation tomorrow. So maybe tomorrow get back to me with the thoughts that you have, and we'll get Ms. Wilson back and we'll have the industry folks back and get the thoughts on what we want to do, and we'll try to put something together for Monday. Representative Seaton.
Thanks. On page 2, line 16 here, if we go to a field designation such as, you know, West Avenue, those are those already all tied up so we don't have to worry about any new players? Because, you know, part of the PPT, it was transferable credits, so that new players that didn't have production taxes would be able to benefit from the credits. And what we're saying here is that only basically three players, probably maybe Anadarko, three or four players will be able to benefit from these credits, is what I'm kind of.
Question saying. For Mr. Van Dyke, probably.
Sure. The chair, Representative Seaton, certainly if Kerr-McGee, for instance, goes ahead with this development, and it would qualify for some potentially some Schrader Bluff credits here. They would have to use those credits themselves, and given all the other credits they would earn from under the PPT from a new development project, they would probably have to sit on these credits, you know, for a few years before they could use them. So they'd have some, you know, diminished value, just time value of money, but my guess is they would eventually use them. They just have to sit on them for a few years.
Okay. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Van Dyke, what about the Chevron lease and a new area-wide sale? That we had talked about that last week. Would that be covered in any of these units now, or would that be an additional area?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, that would be a new area.
I guess that's my concern there. Maybe we can identify that. But that would mean that anything you picked up in a North Slope area-wide lease sale, unless it was in one of those units or PAs, you wouldn't be able to qualify. I guess that's why we have to have that discretion. Then we can find out about the other one. And Mr. Chairman, if I could, on page 2 now of the new bill, we have the little left section that really is what a qualified capital expenditure is. We need to get that clarified.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Van Dyke, can I just make a comment on this section?
Sure.
Certainly.
Page 2, line 22 it's one thing, just so the committee recognizes that the exploration expenditure identified here would be for anywhere in the state and would not just be for challenged oil. So And it would include things like seismic activity. So just that's just a point of information. And then second, you may want to look at the title of the bill, because obviously this expenditure is not for challenged oil or non-conventional oil. So, I mean, this is really a generic or statewide exploration incentive credit. And so, you know, again, policy call whether you grant it or not, but it's really not a challenged oil credit. That's it.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, if I could ask Ms. Wilson to look at this again. I mean, you made a crack, a stab at it a while ago, and I don't think the drafter picked up on it. But this might even needed to be deleted, I think, maybe. I don't know.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Roekberg, we were addressing general topics,
yes.
And I expected we would get back to specific things. I think you were working through your list, and we didn't finish working through that list, but one of my comments that I was going to make was specifically on this section, and that is, yesterday I talked about the title of the qualifying expenditure, and I see that in the non-renewable energy, the title's been changed, and so I think that works. But in this section, the title has not been changed, and the definition does not match the qualified capital expenditure in the PBT, so you've got a disconnect there. So either we need to make a consistent or piggyback or reference that definition, or we need to change the description here. In fact, there's nothing even in this definition that embodies capital. Most of these items that I'm looking at would be ordinary expense.
Okay.
So we still have a problem with that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Recognizing that, that's why the issue about the scope of the whole bill actually drives the redraft here, frankly, I think.
Yeah,
I agree with what you're saying. And that goes back to that election, whether it's going to be a capital or deductible. When I guess my thought was that they should be, unless we change the scope and say new tech or something like that, then it should be consistent with the PPT. But if we're going to carve out a different area, then it may of necessity be slightly different.
And we can make that decision. We can make some decisions
it
tomorrow.
Requires and then, a policy call, then you have to write the language to put the policy.
Let's have the discussion on the issues tomorrow, and then we can work with you on how we want to draft it. So I don't want you to spend some time drafting something that we're going to then change again.
Does that make sense the way I described that? I mean,
yes, absolutely.
Because it reverts back to the federal rules and election and stuff like that. I think.
But. Yes, I think that the main. The main problem there lies in lines 25 through 27 on page 2, because that's really the main departure from PPT. But again, your observation is absolutely correct. Once the policy call is set, then drafting the language will easily follow.
Right.
So just to clarify, the policy decisions we're looking at is whether we're going to use lease expenditures, all development and operational expenditures, or we're going to limit this to capital expenditures, whether going to have research in it or research excluded from it, and whether it's going to be lines 21 through 24 statewide in there or specific fields identified. So are those, I believe those are the policy choices we're talking about. Are there additional policy choices there that we're that I missed?
Through
that's me. I get it.
All right, Mr. Chairman. I believe that recaps the policy calls. My suggestion might be to actually relook at the definition in the PPT, just to sort of refamiliarize everyone. It covers exploration and things that were capitalized under the Internal Revenue Code. So. You're right. Whatever the policy call is, we can write the language. And I noted a moment ago that the definition in the non-renewable, the title's been changed. But just to note that that's a very different definition than what's in the PPT. So, if that's the will of the committee that it cover those kinds of expenditures, then I think that part's fine. But we do need to be certain that the language reflects the intent.
Sure. And so that additional policy call we're talking about is whether we want this bill to be heavy oil, or we want it to be heavy oil and wind energy and everything else, or whether we want to bring it back to heavy oil.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. There are two separate sections, and frankly, I think the renewable energy expenditures have to be a different definition, because they are by nature. I mean, there's no windmills in the PPT, but there are in 028 here. So I'm going to rely on Harry to see if we got the list sufficient here.
Robin?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Roper, you're clearly correct. There's no windmills in the PPT, but the PPT does specify that, you know, it would cover capital expenditures that have been capitalized under the Internal Revenue Code, and that was the focus of the PPT. So it's not the source of the expense, but really how it was treated.
So you're suggesting in the renewables it's not clear, or we need to clarify that better?
Through the chair, Representative Roquebert, what I'm saying is on page 5, that is lines 12 through 16, the only sort of restriction here is that it be ordinary and necessary, which is true of all of the everything, you know, business expenses under the Internal Revenue Code, and that includes ordinary expense that are expensed within the year, and it also includes things that are capitalized. So if the intention of the committee is to restrict it to capitalized items, then that definition needs some work. If the intention is to allow any sort of expenditure with regard to that energy source, then the definition is okay. I just want to make sure that it reflects the intent.
Just to follow up on that, then using say the current language here, in the way the PPT is drafted, but using the 25% tax credit as expressed in the bill, if we left it this way, it would be both a deduction and a CapEx credit, too? Or how would you interpret that?
Through the chair, Representative Roquebert, just to clarify, you're speaking about the definition on page 5?
Yes.
The definition on page 5 would encompass things that were expensed under the Internal Revenue Code. And so, for example, if there was a purchase of biodiesel and that's what was used, then that would be normally expensed in the federal income tax return. It would be subject to a credit here, but it's not capitalized, so it would not be subject to a credit under the PBT. However, the investment in the windmill, you know, that would be a capitalized expenditure. So the thing that's different about this is the expense items.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I'm just uncomfortable with this whole section where we're putting out the oil companies and we're giving them credits for development of, but nobody else. I mean, all of a sudden it's like, well, if you're General Electric or somebody else, or if you're somebody other than an oil production company, you don't get any credit. But if you're an oil company and paying a production tax, we'll give you a tax credit for developing an alternative. And I'm just uncomfortable. I'm definitely not uncomfortable with the idea of trying to develop alternative energy. But to try and say that it's only those people that are paying a oil production tax, I've got a real problem with it in the bill. So.
So, Mr. Chairman, I want to represent Seaton. This lack of comfort is the fact that, number one, doesn't recognize oil companies as energy companies. And secondly, would you be willing to take a tax credit against fishing taxes to build windmills? I mean, that's the same. That's kind of the problem here. This was a source of funds. That's how I was looking at it. An energy company could develop another energy source with a tax credit against a specific revenue generator. So it was a source of funds, really. And it's hard to, you know, without upsetting our total apple.
So would there be a way that we could, whoever decides to develop Fire Island or some other place that they could buy me or take advantage of oil company
credits? I mean, that they could purchase those in some way? I'm not.
To simplify matters, we didn't make these transferable either, as I recollect.
I meant that would be vice versa.
Yeah.
Had it backwards, but.
I mean, I tend to agree. So Siri's going to come to us, and they go, I want a tax credit off of my income tax because I'm going to go build a windmill now. You gave it to Exxon. Why don't you give it to me also? And there we go. I mean, if we want to do that, I would think we would have enough problems with PPG right now.
I'll just try to keep Lord Brown happy.
I understand. I'm with Paul. It's good to develop different ideas, but it could get complicated in a really big hurry by the next person, windmill company that comes in here and might pay an income tax and might not pay an income tax, and they want to credit off their income tax. And then every company.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the topic of transferability, yesterday I commented about the problem of it being transferable to an affiliate. And that has been fixed in the first section. That is, if we look at page 2, line 17, the non-conventional credit is not transferable. But the same fix has not been made to the renewable energy portion. I'm looking at page 5, lines 7 through 9, or 5, I'm sorry, 2 through 9, and that's the same language that I saw yesterday about transferring to an affiliate. So that was a fix that was made in one section but not the other section.
I think that was just an oversight.
I just thought I would note it at this time.
Okay. Do you have more, Ms. Wilson, on going? Do you have a list?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I was thinking we would perhaps just touch on the last few things, but not before you're finished, you know, with the big ideas.
Yes, sir.
And I would just like to ask if Ms. Wilson can generate us some just scenarios of how much tax credit, cumulative tax credit, do we have under the bills. Why don't you just use, for simplicity, the 20%, the 2020 that we had in here, our 2488, and so that we can see what the cumulative tax credits or government, total government payout for expenses would be. I mean, we added up there for one, and that was 117% over research, maybe, or 107%, depending on.
Is that the pig pile effect? Jumping
out there? Yeah, right. I mean, it's at some time you know, well, just trying to figure out where we are. I mean, if we look at the
Counting the federal,
yeah. And I mean, because we got a federal 20% credit, and I don't know how that.
That was on research, though, not on development.
Yes. Yeah. And if we're going to.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe in my last testimony last week, addressing, and not necessarily addressing research, but what I noted at that time was under the PPT, you have the potential of a 20% credit, 20% deduction, and you've got potentially a 35% federal deduction. And then, depending on the type of expenditure it is, at that time I believe we were talking about enhanced oil recovery, and there is a 15% federal credit on enhanced oil recovery, and then this credit would be an additional 15%. Now, I see that we have taken out the provisions about EOR methods in here, but I would suggest that some of the oil recoveries that happen here easily could be subject to that 15% federal credit, even though we're not, you know, specifically targeting that in this bill. So it would depend on which piece of this bill you're looking at. The research, as I noted, can enjoy a 20% federal credit, and I've read through the code section of that. I do not see where there's a requirement that you not count it for a federal deduction. So potentially then, if it's research we're talking about, then you're talking about a 20% federal credit, perhaps a 35% federal deduction. So it kind of depends on which piece you look at.
What's the 35% federal? Is that their
federal deduction?
Mm-hmm. Straight CIT or?
If a deduction is taken and if a company is at a 35% marginal tax rate, then you have the potential of enjoying a 35% benefit.
And did you have on there the state corporate income tax?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is a factor, but I would suggest that it's pretty small because for corporate income tax purposes, we look at the federal credits that were taken. We factor that times 18%, and then we apply an apportionment factor, the amount of business they do in Alaska compared to the rest of the world. So at the end of the day,
does it work out about 9% like the?
No, sir, because we look at worldwide combination. So it's actually, you know, if a company, let us say, did 10% of their business in Alaska, then we would start with what's the federal credit. Now you take 18% of that, and then you take 10% of that, and that's the number you have as a benefit on the state income tax. So it is diluted quite a bit. I think it's safe to say.
You mean, excuse me, so the income that's earned in Alaska, I mean, of course, it's proportioned worldwide, so we don't know what that is, but the corporate tax rate that's going to be paid on that income is going to be about what range? Can you just give me I mean, I know each company is different and everything else, so it's not like the 9.4%. Are you saying it's like 2% corporate tax rate on the income that they would have earned in Alaska? Or
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, if we can just sort of make up some numbers, if the company has income of $100 million, and let's just suppose that they have an apportionment factor of 10%, then that means you'd have taxable Alaska income of $10 million, and you'd have a graduated tax system, but the top marginal rate is 9.4%, so it would be 9.4% of the 10 million, not the 100. So it looks at worldwide income and then says how much of that was in effect earned in Alaska. And that's not on a separate accounting basis, but it's, you know, worldwide and then applying a formula to it. So it absolutely depends on the company.
Sure, but if I can follow up.
Yeah, sure.
So if they had $100 million here in Alaska and they had $1 billion worldwide,
Of income?
Income. So then we're talking that's the apportionment factor would be 10, right? 10%, so it'd be $100 million. It wouldn't be 10% of the $100 million they earned in Alaska. It would be 10% of their worldwide income, so it'd come back to $100 million, and then you'd apply the 9.4% to that.
Yes, so, that is correct.
So with the apportionment, I mean, it should come out somewhere around 9%, shouldn't it?
Well, but if the apportionment factor is it's much less, then if you're asking what the effective tax rate is on worldwide income, it's a little bit apples and oranges.
But I'm just trying to figure out, you know, when we're scheduling out here, what's paid.
Yes.
Okay, never mind. I'll figure it out and then come back.
I could perhaps work with you a little bit on a scenario that we can write up and present.
Keep going through your.
Okay, are we finished with sort of the big picture?
Yeah, well, the next one that comes up, we'll go back to them. Kind of the eye of the beholder, which is big and which is little.
Okay, let's.
Where are we?
Well, I believe we left off on my comment number 7 about the more than once. That was kind of the last place that we were working through it.
Oh, we did that already.
Okay. My comment number 8 about the criteria to judge non-conventional. I think that language is still in here. I understand that there may be some ideas about how to define non-conventional.
Mr. Chairman, I left that alone because it did call out for tar sands and oil shale. But then if we go to the newer language, maybe that, Mr. Spencer, is that, it's not included in here, though.
But we'll also get back then on whether or not we want to go with just geography or not, which would basically solve that problem. Right, Mr. Spencer.
Through the chair, Representative Ropeberg, for the non-conventional, we've got some information here off the Energy Information Administration. It's from the government. It gives some definitions of what is considered non-conventional that you might want to consider for verbiage on that non-conventional part of the legislation.
But there are areas, for example, the Red Dog shallow gas prospect is a shale prospect, I think. And oil shale is a very not uncommon geological formation.
It just
in North America. We just don't happen to have a lot of it around here. You know.
Okay.
Okay, then moving on, I think we've already talked about the issue of the transferability. We've noted that. My comment number 10 about use of credits and the order. I believe Representative Ropeberg asked yesterday about whether that language is still necessary. And since we've fixed the transfer problem in that part, we're fine. The language has come out. I think we're fine on that point. Number 11, my comment had to do with, actually I'll refer you to page 2, line 22.
Are you looking at the Y or L version?
I'm looking at L, line 22, and that problem that I identified has been fixed. What I said was the old version said an exploration expenditure under 4355025. It now says as defined under. So I think that one has been taken care of.
Okay.
My comment number 12, and I think we've noted this previously, but I would just refer you to page 2, line 7. And what I noted yesterday was the inconsistency, because above we said any tax under this chapter, and then we said taxes and surcharges, and that has been fixed here in this version. And I believe it's also been fixed in the non-renewable.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Going back on page 5. On the line 2 on the little d, I think I left that in there because I didn't want to, or I thought it was an oversight. It may not have been, because I recall Ms. Wilson's admonition about it being a regulation about some of this activities, if I'm not mistaken. We didn't want to run afoul of transfers to affiliates and so forth. So I think as a policy call, we want to make these qualified renewable energy expenditure is non-transferable, and just delete the section about the affiliate. Is that, would that be correct?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Roakberg, that would be my recommendation, and that's what has been done in the first section.
Okay. We just, so we need to replicate what we did there by making them non-transferable. Okay. Right, just to clarify. And then, well, then we have the, you did have the one area that I did hold off on was the number 15, that development or use on page 5. Which would be page 5, lines 15. Your comment was it was a little broad.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Roakberg, I believe on the L version we're speaking about page 4. Line 15.
Well, I have a page 5. It's also line 15 on the L version.
Same phrase.
Actually, it's on both.
Same phrase.
Yeah. How convenient.
Okay, and that's your, actually, that's your number 15. So that, right. That has not been addressed yet, okay?
I'm not sure. You indicated it needed some drafting help. It's something that these are, using the windmill analogy again, that's the expenditure occurred for the development or use. Is it the disjunctive or? Or what, do you recall what troubled you about any vagueness or ambiguity or what?
Through the chair, Representative Roakberg, again, I was more concerned about if the language reflected the intent of the committee. Development or use could encompass a lot of expenses.
I see. It's the
pretty broad
intended use rather than just the initial development, if you will.
Yes.
Is that, so the or use, by deleting or use, would that be more comforting?
That would be more comforting.
Before you get into any drafting
things,
we'll wait till tomorrow and we'll start choosing. I mean, it may be a moot point. I mean, I don't know. It may eliminate that section and change this around. But before we make some policy choices, we'll be thinking about the drafting. Right. Probably got plenty to do. So I don't know if you've been through. I mean, you've been through most of this stuff now. On your small things, they're drafting, I mean, you're on 11 right now, but if 12, 13, and 14.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we've taken care of 12.
We did all of those.
And we talked about it. And 13 really is just sort of drafting at the end of the day.
Then let's make choices, maybe make some choices tomorrow, and then we'll get with you on the drafting. Some of this may be moot point, some of that we may have to dig further into on the drafting changes. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With that, Representative Seaton had one more question.
Yeah, I had one question. I mean, go right back to the title where it's credits against production on oil and gas for qualified capital expenditures. I guess this is on the – oh, okay. Maybe I'm misreading it. So this is – there's no question anywhere in this bill that these could be applied to gas production. This is only, everything only is going to be in heavy oil, and it could just be offset against taxes that are incurred on your PPT for oil and gas. I just want to make sure that we don't have any slips here where we get into gas production at all, or gas production in a, are we giving credits for gas production in a heavy oil field?
Well, Mr. Chairman, on that point, it's actually a very good question because, as I recall, the testimony we had from BP regarding the Lisburn prospect, which is carbonate, has significant gas production associated with it. And my preference is to maintain the carbonate in Lisburn. It is in the bill and in even the recommendation for that change of area has, still has Lisburn carbonate field in it. So if there's, there would be some gas production associated with the lift in Lisburn. So maybe Mr. Passavant, if he's still on board, Derek.
Not in the next 10 years, though.
Well, they're producing it now.
Depending on what happens in the next 6 months, what happens in the next 2 years, I mean, you're not going to be producing gas on the slope without a pipeline.
Well, that's true.
So you won't have gas infrastructure. I mean, the big question, I think, is there heavy oil at Point Thompson?
Yeah, that's.
You're talking about the big bucks there. I guess, Mr. Passavant, did you have any question or any comments on the points that were just raised?
Through the chair, the Lisburn is an oil field to us. It does have, you know, gas associated with it, but certainly there is no sales market until the pipeline shows up. So in the envisioned lifespan of this bill, the Lisburn is a challenged oil field.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If we look at removing the statewide application, I mean, if we would go out and we've got Bristol Bay, we got the gas development there, and if there is some heavy oil associated with that, unless we eliminate the statewide provisions and have to come back to the legislature, I just want to make sure we don't get into a situation where we can identify some heavy oil in an area and it's going to be mainly gas producing, and all of a sudden we've given a 15% credit on all the expenditures there because there's some heavy oil associated with Bristol Bay. And so that's why I'm raising this, and I don't think it's the sponsor's intention to say we're going to give 15% tax credit on the development of gas in Bristol Bay if there's any heavy oil that could be associated with that. But anyway, I want to raise it so that it's in our awareness.
I've got a question, I guess, for Mr. Van Dyke then. I wouldn't be as concerned about Bristol Bay because of the 10-year time frame, but the big question would be Point Thompson. Is there heavy oil fields in the entire leased area that mostly Exxon controls, either the expansion leases or the original leases at Point Thompson, that could be considered a heavy oil field?
Mr. Chairman, there are certainly oil resources in the Point Thompson unit, and some of that oil is pretty viscous oil from previous well tests indicate that. So depending on how you defined viscous oil at the end of the day or heavy oil, some of that development certainly could qualify.
But not if we don't name Point Thompson.
Well, that's one of the benefits of going to the site-specific.
Yes, it is.
Definition.
But that's one of the benefits of having to come back to the legislature instead of having the commissioner be able to. Okay.
Boys.
Anyway, or Mr. Chairman, is it something that we need to just have in the bill that it does not include gas development? You know, this isn't a credit for gas resource development and heavy oil field.
Ms. Wilson first, and then I'm going to ask, just so Frank knows that I'll be asking the two engineers here, what type of development could you use for both oil and gas, not counting just re-injecting the gas? If there was a gas pipeline built, what could you get a 15% credit for and then use it for gas also when the gas pipeline, when and if the gas pipeline gets built?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm looking now on page 2, line 26, and when you're talking about development of challenged or non-conventional oil, you know, one of the things I think about is what is the purpose of whatever it is we're doing? Are we building a road or whatever? And when we talk about it's for the development of heavy oil, we start getting into sort of intent. And I think that brings up exactly your point about really the primary purpose of Point Thompson is probably the prize is the gas. And so that's the intent. But then, you know, during audit 2 years later, do I hear, oh, well, our intention was to get heavy oil, right, even though it happened to come up. And I would reiterate your observation that if you go to a field-specific or reservoir-specific allowance, that does away with all that intention.
We will not be naming Point Thompson in this bill. Clarify that right off the bat.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is there, I mean, I don't know West Sac, I don't know the other fields. I mean, do we, is gas development also potential in those fields, even if it's different depth? Because I think we eliminated, we're just talking about physical areas now in which we could be at much greater depths for gas. And do we have that same criteria here?
Mr. Passban?
Yes, Representative Samuels, and through the chair, the Schrader Bluff Agnew formations have very little gas associated with them. That is one of the characteristics that makes them heavy.
Okay. And back to my original question, then, either for yourself or Mr. Spencer or Mr. Van Dyke, what type of a plant is used for both? I mean, if we end up giving a credit for 15% credit for a heavy oil field, gas pipeline comes on, you needed to build it anyway for the gas, and now we've paid 15%. What type of facilities, I mean, obviously not the feeder lines, you can't use it for both, but what type of facilities can be used both for the oil extraction and the gas at a Point Thompson, for instance, if there was some heavy oil at Point Thompson? Is it apples and oranges? I mean, you have to do whatever you're doing for heavy oil, you do for heavy oil, and then you have to do something completely different for gas, and it's simply not a problem?
Well, through the chair, I really do not know that much about the Point Thompson field. I can speak with a bit more expertise on the Prudhoe Bay accumulation, which has gas, oil, heavy oil, and then water. But in general, the heavy oil these are layered in a sequence, gas, oil, heavy oil / tar mat, and then water in the Prudhoe Bay accumulation. And if one were to, say, try and produce gas, you would be better served drilling a well or taking a well that was drilled originally for oil and completing it up into the gas cap and get dry gas, as opposed to trying to develop them jointly. The size of the heavy oil tar mat in Prudhoe Bay is about a billion barrels or a billion and a half barrels kind of volumes, but it sits right on top of water, which is highly mobile, and you would need to have some pretty specialized techniques to drill wells to get after and produce that tar mat. We're actually having too much luck producing that yet.
Okay. Mr. Roper.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Mr. Passman and Mr. Spencer, is there any, number one, typically is there any gas associated with with heavy oil production in these typical formations now? And secondly, couldn't you find a situation where you were doing some kind of an EOR, like even a water flood, that could have the impact of generating both gas and heavy oil?
Through the chair, Representative Roachberg, the heavy oil accumulations do not typically have significant volumes of associated gas, like on the order of one-tenth, let's say, that of a light oil. You know, so the Agnew might have 100 standard cubic feet of gas, where, you know, the Prudhoe Bay might have 1,000 standard cubic feet of gas dissolved in it per barrel. But again, the main target for gas sales, if that's what we're talking about, is the free gas that's just free and clear and standing in a gas cap, as you might find in the original Prudhoe gas cap. And there is not a gas cap associated typically with Schrader Bluff or Agnew.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I just,
yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I guess looking at this definition, we have Lisburn participating area in the Prudhoe Bay unit. So that would be available for this, as we're looking at it right now, in the Prudhoe Bay unit, would be available for this 15% credit. and if that gas was associated with Lisbourne and compressor stations were built and handling and reinjection and all that, that would be available, as my understanding, for a 15% credit for that gas handling, all of that, and then when that comes online, or if, you know, we get gas online, you know, that's already available. Is that, am I all, I don't know the field well, but I see we've got Prudhoe Bay unit established here in this definition. I just want to make sure that we're not backdooring something we don't want to do.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we could just prohibit any credits against gas. I mean,
That's been my question, though, is it's what Rep. Seaton just said. If you have a compressor station for reinjection at Lisbourne, do you use the same station we've now essentially paid for 15% of the station, and it is then used for gas? And the economics of everything changes if a gas line gets built. I mean, it changes for exploration, it changes for the production facilities, it changes for everything.
I think Representative Roakberg just identified what I'm trying to. If we just eliminate credits for gas, then.
But then, then a basic question: what about gas?
Gas used to develop the oil.
And then what about the dilutive, Mr. Spencer? What's the term of art for a dilutive product into a heavy oil?
Through the chair, Representative Roakberg, miscible injection, I believe is the term you're looking for.
Or if there's another D word that's like that. Anyway, whatever you're able to mix with the heavy oil to lighten it up for transport and quality banking.
Diluent.
But if we're talking about produced gas, that means it's not used for that purpose. I mean, if I remember the definitions we had in the PPT.
But if it was, I mean, we might define it as the credit might be applicable to it if we define it that way. In other words, if you use the gas for lifting the heavy oil.
And Mr. Chairman, that's
reinjection. I mean, you know.
What I'm saying is, I think that on our definitions of gas, that's not produced.
Okay, oh, I see what you're getting at there.
So if we eliminate credits for gas produced in a field, then unless I'm definition.
Didn't we a few years back have a lawsuit with that over with BP over that, and because they weren't paying any kind of tax when they took it out and put it back in the ground, and Noel settled out of court on that case for $3
billion. $3 billion? Well, we've spoken to with PPD. I mean, it's clear. And there is a policy, I think you're right, Jim, about there was some action and there was an agreement there, or whatever it was.
Ms. Wilson, go ahead.
Backing up a little bit.
We're going to go on for about five more minutes here. We're kind of digressing a bit.
But backing up just a little bit, you asked the question, Mr. Chairman, are there facilities that could be used for both bringing up oil and bringing up gas, if I understood your question correctly?
Is there a compressor station that is going to be built that the state's going to essentially pay 15% of, another 15% of, on top of all the other credits? Because it will be very truthfully said, this is a heavy oil facility or piece of equipment or whatever it is, and then a gas line gets built, and now we've paid 15% for something which was essentially there for the gas.
I'm actually backing up a sentence or two past
okay.
that.
All right. Go and right ahead. I'll shut up.
And I guess that's what piqued my interest. You know, certainly there are facilities. If we take something as simple as a road to the well, that road is being built to develop it, and you're probably going to have oil come out of that well as gas, whatever it is you ultimately do with the gas. If you go to your idea of identifying specific areas or reservoirs that are heavy oil, and that you're going to give a credit for everything that happens in that, then it really simplifies matters. Because you're not making judgments about what was the primary purpose of building the road. If you don't do that and you discuss about not crediting investments that are gas specific, And I guess the next question is, okay, what do we do about allocating costs of expenditures that were made, you know, that brought up both gas and oil? So sort of another reason to go to the lease or the area specific.
Particularly if I don't know, Mr. Paskin, what was the number you gave that said at a normal heavy oil field you've only got 10% or 15% of the gas, of the associated gas?
Representative Samuels, yes, you may have 100 or 200 standard cubic feet per barrel of oil dissolved in a heavy oil.
Okay. And that pretty much alleviates my concerns right there, is that there's just not that much gas there.
Representative Samuels?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
To speak to your question about gas facilities associated with oil production, the project that we're looking at in Western Prudhoe Bay is an oil development project, but what we do is use recycled gas to lift the oil out of the wells. It's a gas lift mechanism. So as the well starts to produce water from injection, you re-inject into the well outside the tubing, production tubing, what's called gas lift gas. And that allows the oil and water that's coming out of the well to produce to the surface. If you didn't inject that gas lift gas, the well would not flow to the surface. So that requires us to install a gas compressor to handle the gas lift gas and recycle that gas lift gas through the compressor into the wells, back through the production facility, back to the compressor in a big loop, and thereby producing the oil from the well. So in that case, you're investing, you have to invest to develop the oil. You have to invest in water handling, water injection, gas compression facilities to develop the oil field.
Okay. Mr. Spencer?
Representative Samuels, just to elaborate on it a little bit, what Frank was talking about there is artificial lift, using the gas to artificially lift the heavy oil out of the ground.
Yeah. I didn't have any problem with that. You just don't want to end up paying for 15%, another 15% of a GTP somewhere.
Right.
You know, that's the general question. But if it just doesn't produce as near as much gas as the Prudhoe Point Thompson, I really don't have a big, and
I guess my question was that under the definition challenged oil, we were talking about 5,500 feet or less, but we're also now talking about a geographic area, and we're kind of no longer back to the 5,500 feet unless we include that. So that might, if we include the 5,500 feet or less and the geographic area, then we don't have to probably worry about going down and producing the conventional gas. If maybe that would work.
If we go to the geographic area, I think it's all part of the problem. I'd like to try to get out of here now. Tomorrow we'll adjourn this meeting. Tomorrow we meet at 1 o'clock at the regular time, and I think everybody's kind of get back to me tomorrow during the meeting on kind of where we want to head, generally speaking, on some of these bills. Mr. Spencer, do you have another comment?
I just have one more comment, just since we did pass out this proposed definition of challenge oil. Just wanted to give a one-minute explanation. Neither myself nor Frank are policy writers, and we were kind of looking at this from a practical matter. And basically, what we tried to do here is on C, basically list out the oil pools that we thought would be applicable for meeting the challenged oil definition. A and B are exactly as were written in the original bill, and why we thought it would make some sense in leaving those in is because it provides some guidance to the department on what would qualify as a viscous oil project in the future, something that we currently don't, you know, something that's out there in the future that we don't currently know about. And then the last one, Part D, further gives a discretion to the department to decide if there's some other reason other than stated in A and B of why an oil field would be challenged, and gives them the discretion to either say thumbs up or thumbs down on that proposal. So kind of
our thinking was there. It identifies the known horizons in C, gives some guidance on the north slope in A, the rest of the state in subsection B, and then D is for anything else that we missed. So that was kind of the overall logic there, so hopefully that makes some sense.
Okay. Representative Seaton had a question for Mr. Van Dyke, and then we're going to try to adjourn this meeting.
And Mr. Van Dyke, I was wondering whether you could just write out in fax to the Representative Samuels what your list of the geographic areas and would be in that you would propose that we should include in this, realizing this is only a 10-year horizon on this thing, so we don't have to worry about, you know, too long in the future.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I can do that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Spencer just pointed out, having some standards within the definition, I think, has some merit, particularly like using the total vertical depth of 5,500 feet, I think gives the director even to make these determinations, even though we may specify the area. And I will tell you, there's going to be a continually ongoing debate about what constitutes heavy oil at what API gravity there is. I mean, I'll be the first to admit, I drafted the bill, we worked with Joe Green when he had a bill in 1996 to provide additional incentives on heavy oil, then used the standard of 20. So there is an issue here. So if we, even though we call them out, if we don't have some standard there, I'm kind of concerned about that, particularly if we're looking at future additions or review by the department. So I'm kind of concerned not to have that in there, or unless it's just a guideline. I mean, because you're going to have that kind of debate
will continue.
Yeah,
sure.
Continue unless we set the standard. I mean, that, and I appreciate and I accept the idea of specifying the location here, and I think that has merit. But without having at least some of those standards to define what in fact heavy oil is, I think we're going to
have the same argument.
We're going to have the same argument and the same kind of discretion. You say, oh well, this could be from that area, but then it's really, you know, it's 26 API or it's whatever it is, and you know, by the way, I measured it that day, you know, kind of thing that we might have trouble with. So I'm kind of torn on that one.
Okay. Ms. Wilson, you get the last comment.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the idea that having some standards in there and defining heavy oil would be helpful in a definition section. I think it'll just require some careful drafting to sort of move these, because given this description the way it is, we still have sort of the same problem we've got now. And so I could see them separated to have these fields qualify for the credit and any other fields the department thinks is heavy oil, and then this is what heavy oil is, probably with the word.
Okay. That's why engineers and lawyers don't mix. Okay. Tomorrow at 1, we can kind of flesh that out so everybody can think about it. If you have some ideas, you want to get them to me, or get them to me at the meeting tomorrow, and then I will work with the sponsor and Ms. Wilson and the drafters and Mr. Mintz and everybody else and try to get a CS crafted by the first part of next week. We can kind of get the ideas fleshed out tomorrow on what we want to do with the bill. And with that, we're adjourned.